Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Big Nerdy Questions. I'm Josh, and with me tonight are Matt.
Hello.
And from episode 1, Colleen is back.
Namaste.
And tonight, our question is our first yes or no question. Simply, are the Star Wars prequels redeemable? We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of this most controversial topic in just a minute. But first, Matt, who's our sponsor tonight?
Well, Josh, tonight's sponsor is Boba's Bail Bonds. Boba's Bail Bonds, stopping fugitives cold since 1980.
What a fantastic sponsor. Thank you, Boba's Bail Bonds. And Colleen, do you have a big nerdy recommendation for us tonight?
Yes, I do. It's a trilogy of books. It's called The Old Kingdom or The A Course in Trilogy, written by Garth Nix. Three books. The first one is Sabriel, second is Lyrael, and the third is The A Course in. It's really cool, easy read, young adult novel. It's awesome. It's about The A Course in, who is a necromancer whose job is to slay the undead.
That sounds fantastic. I'll have to check that one out myself.
They're really good.
So on that note, we don't have any feedback yet for our last episode on X-Men Mutations. We'll get to that in our next episode. So we're going to jump right in to the Star Wars prequels debates. As you know, listeners, I'm a huge fan of Star Wars, but I'm much more of a fan of Trek. However, Colleen and Matt are both Star Wars super fans and know quite a bit about this topic. So I'm going to turn it over to Colleen first of all. Please give us your thoughts on the prequels and their redeemability.
So this is something I've put a lot of thought into many years, and every year I tend to have a rant at some length about the prequels. But simply put, are the prequels redeemable? Yes, but only really from a certain point of view. So the plot of the prequels is absolutely incredible. How one man was able to bring the Jedi Order and a 1,000-year-old Republic to its knees is mind-blowing. But the problem is it's just not obvious in the movies, like, at all. So, for example, for me to actually be able to finally understand what was going on, I ended up having to watch the Attack of the Clones, like, 5 times in a row, and I took notes. So, yeah, it's not an easy thing.
Serious business.
I was determined. Because when I first saw the movie, Attack of the Clones, like, something was niggling in the back of my head going, wait a minute, I'm not getting something here. I'm missing something important. So I went back after the movies came out, and I literally watched Attack of the Clones 5 times in a row. So anyway.
Wow.
Either I gained a lot of insight, or I went insane, and that's up to the internet to decide. But essentially, to really view the plot and all three of the prequels, you have to just ignore the poorly written dialogue, the horrible acting, and obvious gratuitous use of the CGI, and just focus on the plot. Basically, it just starts with the Trade Federation's blockade of Naboo in The Phantom Menace, which Palpatine then uses to leverage his election as Supreme Chancellor of the Republic. So then, in Attack of the Clones, Palpatine actually manipulates events. So the Jedi use the clones to attack the Separatists first, and that brings the Republic into a war. And, of course, the war is the focus of Revenge of the Sith. So Palpatine clearly aims to furiously undermine the Jedi. So you look at it from this point of view. The Jedi ordered the clones. The Jedi used the clones to start the war. The Jedi led the clones during battle, you know, in the war, because they were generals, etc. The Jedi then attacked the Chancellor, and then the Jedi, tried to take over the Republic. So, essentially, Palpatine makes it look as if the clones are the army of the Republic. I mean, army of the Jedi, not the Republic. So, Palpatine manages to create enough fear of the Jedi in the Republic so that when the Jedi demand Palpatine relinquish his, like, authoritarian wartime powers, it's actually the Jedi who look like threat and not Palpatine. And he does this so well, the Republic actually supports him when he orders the complete destruction of the Jedi Order. So then after the so-called betrayal, you know, of the Jedi, the threat of the Separatists still exists. And at this point, the Sarah is, like, completely terrified. They don't see that Palpatine deliberately created this fear. They don't see that they're being manipulated into giving up their freedom. So they're so afraid of losing control, of losing this war, and of losing the Republic, that in this, like, knee-jerk attempt to save the Republic, they actually hand over complete control to Palpatine. And thus rises the Galactic Empire.
Well done.
Hey, we don't have money to go past a sample.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, are the prequels redeemable? I'd say, and you can argue this too, that from a certain point of view, actually, maybe no. Because, look, everything I just described is actually already there. So you don't really need to redeem something that already exists. I admit that there's a lot of irritating nonsense in those movies. Jar Jar, cough, cough.
Midichlorians.
Yeah, Jar Jar. I mean, I hate how Padme was supposed to be this amazing, strong female character, but instead spends, like, almost all her time wearing pretty clothes and crying. I hate how Anakin comes across as a whiny teenager. Oh, gee, I wonder where Kylo Ren gets it.
And I hate he is a teenager.
Not in episode 3, he's not, he's 23. I mean, I hate that I had to watch, again, Attack of the Clones 5 times to see this amazing plot, but it's there. So I challenge everyone to look beyond what you see on the surface in these movies. Just let go of the truths you cling to and view the prequels using a different point of view. You might just end up, oh my goodness, liking what you find, or at least hating them a little less.
So can I ask a clarifying question? Episode 2 seems to be the one where the narrative, although buried, is coherent to a point and actually very good. So does that in turn change the negative perception of episode 3 or episode 1?
I actually think that of the three of them, that episode 2 is the best, only because that's where this plot becomes incredibly obvious. You don't really see it in episode 1 because you're like, who is this Trade Federation and who really cares that they're, you know, they want higher taxes? Whoopee, you know? The whole point of episode 1 was to get Palpatine into power, the Sith reappearing, and then, oh, they find the Chosen One. That's basically episode 1. Episode 3's focus is on the fall of the Jedi Order, the fall of Anakin, and the fall of the Republic. But it's episode 2 that shows you those threads that actually connect episodes 1, 2, and 3. You know, because episode 2, you start and you see that the Republic is considering creating this army because there's a handful of systems that want to leave the Republic. I mean, that's a huge thing because it's like, really? I mean, have negotiations already broken down to a point where both sides are considering war? And the Separatists really aren't bad. I mean, you know, they really aren't. It's only a handful of systems, and the Republic has got, like, what, like 500 or plus, you know, however many systems, planets, that belong to the Republic. So for having a handful of planets say, you know what, we don't want to be here, really isn't that big of a deal. I mean, the Republic's not going to crumble because, like, 7 planets decide not to be part of it anymore. The main issue is that those planets that are leaving, they're the Trade Federation, they're the Mining Guild, they're the Techno Federation or whatever. So what you have here are planets that provide the main resources, raw resources, needed for the Republic to actually function. That's where they're afraid, because if these planets do leave, then you're going to have to start to renegotiate all kinds of trade agreements. The Republic's not going to get their services for free or for very cheap. They're going to have to pay a lot more money, so they don't want them to leave because of that. Think of it as like Brexit, but in Star Wars. So anyway, it's got to the point where you've got that they're basically thinking about creating an army. The Republic has never had an army before, ever. And Palpatine asks the Jedi, hey, do you want to be that army? And they say, no, you know, we're peacekeepers. We don't have anything to do with, you know, armies and fighting and blah, blah, blah. Well, so then Padme, who's in charge of, like, well, she's basically leading the opposition against creating this army. Someone wants her dead bad enough to try to blow her up in front of all of Coruscant, which is, like, basically saying, hey, to the entire galaxy, we don't like her. Personally, if I was Padme, I never would have, like, run away, like, with my tail between my legs. I would have stood and fought for my ideals and my beliefs, and at very worst, become a martyr for this cause. But she doesn't do that. She runs away, and I hate that they do that. But anyway, whatever. So then the Jedi go trying to find out, oh, why do people want her dead? You know? Anyway. And in the course of that investigation, Obi-Wan discovers that there's this massive clone army essentially being created, that it was the Jedi, supposedly, that ordered this army, even though the Council says, we never get any authorization, we have no idea what you're talking about. That's highly alarming, that somebody is trying to pin this on the Jedi. And it really bothers me that the Jedi, especially Yoda, never bothered to go, wow, that's a huge problem, what the hell's going on? Furthermore, it's also a huge, or should be a red flag, that this army is ready for deployment at the exact same time that the Republic also happens to be considering, you know, creating an army. The army was, the clones were ordered, what, 10 years ago is what it says in the movies. What happened 10 years ago? That's when the Trade Federation blockaded Naboo, Palpatine rose to power, and the Sith reappeared. This is not a coincidence. These are huge red flags, and they never seem to act on them. Instead, what they do is that the Jedi, with Yoda at the helm, literally attack the Separatists. And at this point, there's no war. You know, there's still negotiations, it's tense, but there's no war. And then Yoda and the Jedi literally come raining Jedi down onto the planet, and they start shooting at, you know, the Separatists. The Republic essentially, thanks to the Jedi, declare war.
It's kind of a literal, it's raining men.
It's literally raining Jedi and raining death at that point. So the Jedi actually start this war. The Jedi are using the clones that on paper, the Jedi created. So even though in Episode 3 they don't go this route, Palpatine could very easily have said, hey, look, the Jedi were the ones who did all this. They ordered the clones. They created them. They used them. They started this war. They're the ones who've been leading the clones this entire time. This is their army. They are a huge threat to us. And that threat only becomes more apparent when they literally attack Palpatine. Yes, I know that we know he's a douchebag and that he's an evil Sith Lord. But the senators don't know that. The average citizen in the Republic doesn't know that. All they see are the Jedi who have these massive superpowers, which if you remember in The Phantom Menace, people are already afraid of them because they don't understand these powers.
Magic space wizards.
Well, yeah, but you think, remember the Republic, they send, or Chancellor Valorum in The Phantom Menace, sends Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon to negotiate, you know, the end of this blockade on Naboo. But as soon as the members of the Trade Federation realize they're Jedi, they freak out. That's really unusual response. You know, I mean, why would they be afraid of the Jedi if the Jedi are so great? So Palpatine manages to capitalize on this fear that already exists of the Jedi. It makes it so bad, reaches to a point that the Republic and the Senate feels threatened enough by the Jedi, that they are okay with the complete and utter destruction and genocide of the Jedi. It's an absolutely brilliant plot, and you see this, all of this becomes very, very apparent in Episode 2, and it culminates in Episode 3. Brilliant plot, it just gets buried underneath senseless nonsense about, love story, and Anakin wants to be more powerful, and Jar Jar does stupid things. It's just not evident. But it is very, very brilliant. You know, hats off to the writers and people who created that. It's too bad it just got buried and it's not obvious because it's absolutely amazing. Palpatine is a douchebag, but you have to admire him for pulling one over the entire galaxy.
What's your take on that theory, Matt?
I'm just trying to figure out when she had time in the monologue to take a breath.
It's a very impressive.
I have a lot of time to think of this.
Well, my response actually is related to hers. But in order to give my response properly, Colleen, you speak Chinese. I don't. How do you pronounce this?
What am I looking at?
The
God. I know Quan is. Oh, wait, hold on. I gotta pull it up again because it disappeared. Hold on. Where's my little thingy?
How do you pronounce Z-U-I?
It's
Shui?
Shui? Yeah, Shui Quan. Shui Quan?
Shui Quan.
Anyone on the internet were totally wrong, I apologize. And if we completely just butchered that and said something completely different from what it's supposed to be, please have fun laughing at our expense.
That's what we're here for.
So Shui Quan is, when translated into English, drunken fist. And that is the linchpin of my theory, which on Reddit many years ago, a user in a thread discussing a similar question named Lumpawaru, because I'm going to give credit where it's due. Lumpawaru posited this theory, and it's pretty similar to yours, but the mastermind is not Palpatine. It's, in fact, the single character we all hate the most, and we kill him every night, Jar Jar Binks. And this user, I don't know if it's a he or a she, so I will use gender-neutral terms, posited the theory that there is no way Jar Jar Binks is not a Force user. Because if you look at the acrobatics and movements that he does, they are just not performed by anyone who is not actively using the Force at the time. And I think that this theory is the only way that the prequels stand a chance of still, by future volumes, being redeemed. Because if in episode 8 or 9, Snoke's identity is revealed to not be the image shown in the hologram in episode 7, but instead it's an avatar used by Darth Binks to hide his identity.
Possible spoiler alert.
Well, we have a spoiler. We have a spoiler warning on the stream page. So, yeah. If you didn't read the spoiler alert warning, hey, there's a hologram of a bad guy that we're not entirely sure it's actually what he looks like. Now, Jar Jar Binks is constantly moving around like he's drunk, but it always just happens. And I'm making air quotes. I know you can't see me out there, but I'm making air quotes right now. He just happens to always dodge blaster bolts. He does kipping, he sloshes, he uses leg sweeps. In, I believe it's in episode 2, the giant battle with the droids, with all the droids with funny looking heads. One grabs his leg after it's been cut in half, and he swings it around with his leg and causes, it actually sets off its blaster without touching it with anything but the ankle it's attached to, and is taking out droids while making it look like he's this hapless idiot. He can jump 20 feet straight up, do a triple somersault flip into the water, and make a perfect dive. And he's clearly a master martial artist. And Shui Kwan greatly matches his style of physical movement. So I think he is operating much like I studied the Emperor of Japan, Hirohito. I studied his career in graduate school. And there I found, in my opinion, numerous parallels between Hirohito as a figurehead leader and Jar Jar Binks, as strange as it sounds. I really doubt anyone's ever going to compare the Emperor of Japan to Jar Jar Binks, but I'm about to do it. Both of them are constantly placing themselves in situations in which they can always say, oh no, I'm just hapless and I have no control over this situation whatsoever. They are masters of plausible deniability. They are absolute masters of plausible deniability. But at the same time, they're clearly also, if things go their way, they can claim the responsibility and say, it was me all along, but they always have an out to abscond without responsibility. And I believe that Darth Binks realized that he needed to wait longer beyond just the creation of the Empire to see if it would pan out in the long run before revealing himself as the true mastermind. And so he could still reveal himself in episode 8 or episode 9 as the true villain of the entire series of films, which would create this massive overarching story that would tie everything together except for those incredibly, I'm sorry, Mr. Lucas, but midichlorians can die in fire. But he just, every time he speaks and influences people, he gesticulates wildly, but he always makes sure to move his fingers in a semicircular pattern. And when someone's moving their fingers in a semicircular pattern while rotating their wrist in the Star Wars universe, they are using the Jedi mind trick.
It's not the Gungan you're looking for.
Exactly.
Rey doesn't do that in episode 7, but that's okay.
Well, I can't remember whether or not we can see her other hand.
Her hands are kind of like bound. But anyway, it's okay.
Well, she's bound really at the lower forearm, just above the wrist.
I think I might say that My guess on that is you don't have to use the hand motions, but it sort of goes along with it. Sometimes you can.
Right. And for the record, for our listeners, for those of you who do not already know but have seen The Force Awakens, the stormtrooper that she does the Jedi mind trick on is played by none other than Daniel Craig. So, yes, she used the Jedi mind trick on James Bond.
Who apparently can never die.
Speaking of Bond, we're still looking for recipes for our new alcoholic beverage, Magneto Screwdriver, from our last episode. Submit those to us.
I'd stand by my previous assertion that if I think the recipe will work, I will actually try it and review it.
So, Matt, I need to ask a clarifying question. And correct me if I'm wrong, because like I said, you guys know Star Wars better than I. But in recalling most of the major events from the first three episodes, aside from the major battle with the droids, Jar Jar seems to avoid most dangerous situations. Am I wrong on that, Matt?
I think he creates them.
Well, the thing is, I only remember him being involved in two violent incidents. One being the gigantic battle with the battle droids, in which, you know, massive casualties all around, and he comes out unscathed and has numerous kills. I mean, he has active confirmed kills.
And Padme is injured and he's not.
Yes. And there's another point where, if you'll remember, Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon Jinn take Jar Jar along with them to execute an ambush. And I believe it was in Phantom Menace.
Yeah, because after that, Jar Jar spends his time in the Senate.
Yeah. But when Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan jump down, if you're paying close enough attention, Jar Jar jumps with them, but in mid-jump, he spins around, grabs the ledge, and throws himself in a different direction, dodges blaster bolts, and disappears.
When he falls.
Well, I actually found a GIF of that moment from the scene, and he actually spins around, grabs it, and he comes down in a different location than where he would have been if he had fallen straight.
It sounds similar to what a certain character did in The Force Awakens.
Yes. I'm thinking that he did an off-screen force jump to the side. A droid fires on his position he was in, but he's already gone.
Yeah, and we have to remember that. Remember, Jar Jar was banished from the Gungan place because of, well, again, he tends to invite trouble.
Yeah.
To quote Taylor Swift, they knew he was trouble when he walked in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it would have been a really cool reveal or, you know, additional plot if Jar Jar ended up being, you know, the Sith Lord or, you know, the Sith Lord behind or another Sith Lord. I think that would have been really cool. If that was part of the original plot, they scrapped it after the very hugely negative response to Jar Jar's character.
Yeah, that's actually the logic that Lumpawaru used in positing the theory, is that they were planning to reveal Jar Jar either at the end of Episode 2 or sometime in Episode 3. But because of how much vitriol and just the incredible backlash against the character there was, that they scrapped it and they kept a lot of what he did, but they never had the reveal. It just wrote him off as the comic relief.
Right, because, you know, in Episode 1, they didn't find, you know, the droids until much later. And those have, you know, they've always typically been the, you know, the comic relief, the comedic relief in the film.
Right.
I mean, and here, it should be interesting if they do bring Jar Jar. I don't think they will bring Jar Jar back, though, honestly, for the final trilogy, because so many people hate him. In fact, I know that, what was it?
Abrams tried to put his skeleton in the desert.
Exactly.
And he got laughed at by the other producers, and that's the only reason he didn't do it.
Well, see, exactly. That's the point. I don't think they're going to bring him back. Another thing is, even if people, because I think it's pretty clear that at the end of Return of the Jedi, when they do in the, well, I think it was like the 2004-ish or whatever it was released, no, the one after that, whatever, where they have Naboo, and they hear a little Gungan voice and see go, we set free. I'm pretty damn sure it's Jar Jar. But I don't think it would be highly unlikely that by the end of this third trilogy that Jar Jar would still be alive. There are several sources online that say that for Gungans, their lifespan, if you reach 65, you're considered like old as hell for a Gungan. And so assuming that Jar Jar was like even in his 20s, I know, by the time the Phantom Menace, I mean, he has got to be dead. He would be like in his 70s.
So I'm right. Picturing the AARP for Gungans, which is just fantastic.
Well, in response to that, I would point out that I know it's no longer canon, but in the expanded universe, it was well documented in many, many, many of the books that Sith could use the power of the dark side to actually extend their lifespan.
Which is very interesting because the dark side doesn't beget life. And we can have a whole other discussion on about whether or not Palpatine or his master, Darth Plagueis, were actually the quote-unquote father of Anakin, because that is just a theory that I love. But, you know, who created life, creating life through the Force, because Plagueis experimented on that, whether he created, you know, finished his experiment. There's this thing online, a theory online.
I used to say he didn't learn that from Darth Banks.
You know, I think that's a fantastic theory, and I think we'll come back to it in a later episode. I know we're a little shorter on time this episode, so I want to ask you both, from someone who is a fan but not as big a fan as you both, as both of you are, when I watched the prequels, and for the record, I think if either one of you, if Colleen's theory is right, which I think your theory is right, it's just buried, and if your theory was right, Matt, it would make the prequels so much more interesting. But watching it just as is, having seen the original trilogy than the prequels, what really bothered me the most, even more so than Jar Jar, was the horrible development of the relationship between Anakin and Padme. And
there's an argument to be made on that, too.
I really think that it ruined the plot, because it was such a narrow... You can tell Lucas wanted these trilogy to be the story of Anakin Skywalker, the rise and fall of the Chosen One. But the narrow focus on the relationship only works if the relationship is well written. And honestly, I think it is written... The only relationship that I know of that's written worse is Bella and Edward in Twilight.
That's harsh.
So what do you guys think about that?
The prequels really just suffered from too many plot elements. And it just they had a really hard time deciding, A, what to focus on, and then, B, clearly articulating, you know, their plots and what they wanted to accomplish in those films. That's why it just becomes such a huge jumble of stuff, and it's so hard to focus and to figure out what exactly is really going on. Should I focus on what's going on in the Republic, you know, with the Jedi, or should I focus on Anakin's personal problems with the Jedi, or should we focus on, you know, Padme and what she's trying to accomplish as a senator? Should we focus on, you know, their relationship? I mean, what's going on here? It's too much.
Well, there is a theory that has been passed around a few spots online that the way to partially redeem, because frankly, there's a lot of really bad acting. And there is way too much CGI in the films. But there is an argument to be made that the relationship developing between Anakin and Padme, especially with how much she virulently disapproves of him at the beginning of episode one, and yet, you know, she's willing to take a run at him in the sack by the end of episode three, the argument is made that it's meant to show his power within the Force growing without him controlling it well and it being tied to his emotions. Because she seems to develop Stockholm Syndrome as she goes along. And the argument is that he is subconsciously influencing her opinion of him using the Force.
It just totally improves my, you know, point of view of how I view Anakin, not... Great. But I think what they were trying to come across was that there was a struggle between both of them. Like, he's a Jedi, she's a senator, it's a forbidden love. And it just, that struggle just came across, like, as he's a stalker and she's totally not interested, and then, oh wait, then they come together. It just did not develop well in the film.
Well, at least he didn't cut her breaks, so he could save her.
And I just want to quickly address the issue with the CGI. Yes, there's a lot of CGI in those movies, but you have to admit that by the time you get to episode 3, there's not nearly really as much as there were in the first two. You think about the time period in which these movies were developed, CGI was like the thing at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a really big deal. It's like, look what we can do with computers. This is awesome. And I think film producers hadn't yet figured out that there really needs to be a balance between, CGI and then models, etc. And so these were like some, especially Phantom Menace was really early, Attack of the Clones was early. And then you have the audience's reaction. So in a sense, it's using that technology. I think it was still kind of in the early stages, more experimental stages. And audience's reaction to what we perceive to be the overuse of CGI, I think eventually is what changed, filmmakers' perception when they were making movies later. It's just these were the big movies at the time, and they happened to use that technology, and so they get the brunt of, our displeasure for how this new technology was being used. So I think we could give Lucas a break on that.
And I will say that I personally believe that one of the most visually arresting scenes in the entire franchise is the lightsaber duel in episode 3 between Anakin and Obi-Wan on the volcano planet. It's visually arresting. I'm not saying the scene itself is fantastic, but it's very visually appealing, and that is partially due to the CGI being very well done. I should mention here that Allison, who is also one of our regular panelists, she couldn't be here tonight for this episode, but she did tell me to convey to the panel that she doesn't think that episode 3 needs redemption, because she actually thinks it's a quality film on its own as is. She doesn't like 1 and 2, but she wanted me to mention that episode 3 is one of her favorites of the whole franchise. It's not a monolithic opinion that all the prequels are stereotyped to be negative, but it's not always seen negative by every viewer. And I should point out, I've talked to some people who saw the prequels before the original trilogy, and they like the prequels more, I think, than people who saw the originals first, for whatever reason.
Either way, you know the internet's gonna flame us for this episode, right?
That's the whole point. But I think that both of you have submitted interesting ways to look at the prequels in a different light. And Colleen, to your point, you've told me this theory before, and it really changed my view of the prequels, because if you're able to get past all the negatives that we've talked about in this episode, that plot that you describe is really amazingly well done, and is a fantastic plot of intricate politics and tensions building and megalomania, so that it's really well done. Also, Matt, your theory, I think, is a fantastic one, because I love when...
It's the only way to justify that character's existence?
Yes, but I also love when you never are expecting the villain to be that who you are. Spoiler alert for this film, like in The Usual Suspects. It would be Jar Jar as Kaiser Soze, which would be the best twist in cinema history if they actually did it in episode 8 or 9. If they have the guts to do that, all hail the current filmmakers, because it would make the Jar Jar hate justified, because he's suddenly the worst person in the entire universe.
The only reason I think they won't do that is because of how virulent the hatred of the character is.
I agree.
I think if he had been treated as the bumbling comic relief, like they were trying to show him as portraying himself as, I think if he had been taken as, this odd character who something's a bit off, but he's always getting out of these situations and always seeming to benefit, I think they would be able to do that in episode 8 or 9. But because of how polarizing a figure Binks really is, I do not think they would dare to bring him back in 8 or 9. So, because I think, frankly, it would tank whoever the director is. I think it would tank their career.
I agree. I think it would destroy the Star Wars franchise completely at that point. But just briefly, it's like, for me, my opinion on this topic, are the prequels redeemable? No, they don't have to be redeemable because they really are awesome enough on their own. You just have to look at for the plot and just look at the movies from a slightly different point of view.
Matt, would you agree with that assessment?
My final judgment is I'm going to disagree with Colleen. I'm going to say that as they stand, they are an irredeemable affront to cinema. But if they were to make the change of revealing Jar Jar Binks as, like, Count Dooku's master, I think it would turn it into a brilliant think piece.
So I'm going to say...
Internet, go ahead, paint me.
They probably will. My opinion, before you told me your theory, Colleen, of the prequels, I was of the opinion that I would say it's completely unredeemable. There's no way to save the prequels. Now I'm not so sure. I think I would put out an opinion that's between the two of you. I would say episode one is an abomination to cinema and should be killed with fire. But episodes two and three can be saved, or really don't need to be saved, because there's good in there if you get through the minutiae. But we'll want the listeners' feedback. There's going to be a lot of opinions on this one. So listeners, please give us your opinions. Are the prequels redeemable? Do they need to be redeemed at all? Please let us know on Twitter at BNQ Podcast, through our email, which is bnqfeedback@gmail.com or bignerdyquestion@gmail.com. We take feedback in either place. And we really hope that you'll let us know. We will read out your feedback on later episodes because we will revisit Star Wars again and again on this show. So let us really know what you think. There is one more piece of business to take care of. Matt, you've been talking about him all night. We have to kill Jar Jar Binks.
That's right, Josh. Well, since tonight we've been talking about the theory of Darth Binks, we're going to have to kill him in the same way that some people theorized that Darth Jar Jar actually died, and that is that he was left to die on the cutting room floor.
All I request, listeners and viewers, is simply remember the prequels. There is still good in them.
There is good in them. I can feel it.
Well, yes, Jim Jackson.
And on that note, thank you, Colleen.
Thank you, Josh.
And thank you, Matt. And this Jar Jar is dead. BNQ is not. Good night, everybody.